Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for this invitation. So today I'd like to share with you some data with the fly model, which is a bit exotic to this audience. But I'll try to convince you that we can learn from the flies on the host microbiota interaction field. We use Drosophila to study symbiosis, which are host microbes interaction. And as you all know, host microbes interaction range, it's basically a continuum of interaction type that lead to either damage for the host physiology, for pathogenic types of interaction, or other type of interaction are mutualistic interaction, which lead to benefit for the host physiology. And as I said, it's a continuum with extreme cases, such as lethal infection, or on the other side of the spectrum, obligate symbiosis. And today we will mostly speak about those types of interaction mutualism. Obviously, there was some historical leading figures in those fields that clearly describe pathogenic types of interaction, Louis Pasteur here in France, or Robert Koch in Germany. But also two very important figures were Ilya Metchnikov and Henri Tissier. And the work I'm mentioning of Ilya Metchnikov, it's not his work on phagocytosis, but his later work on actually all the theories he had, and actually some work about the role of the intestinal microbiota in aging processes. And actually, Henri Tissier was the first to isolate some bifidobacteria here in Pasteur Institute in France. So they actually characterized and they theorized a lot of the host microbes interaction, but now we clearly need to understand what is the molecular dialogue between host and microbes, and what are the mechanisms that underlie those interactions. And today we will speak about mechanisms that underlie mutualism. So thanks to the previous speakers, you know a great deal about the intestinal microbiota, its composition, its complexity in human and in mammals. It's clearly an obvious case of mutualistic symbiosis, because microbiota live in nutrient-rich environment in the intestinal lumen, full of nutrients. And it has some very important functions for the biology of its host and for human health, because it contributes to metabolism, immune system. We'll probably hear about behavioral impact also today. And as a consequence, the microbiota composition or activity has been linked to several diseases related to those functions. Obviously, this is a fascinating field, which is progressing very fast, very complex field. But now we clearly have to understand all the physiological benefits associated to those interactions. But one would like also to understand the exact molecular mechanisms underlying those interactions, and what are the mechanisms, the detailed mechanisms, engaged in those mutualistic association or pathogenic association. So for that, we choose to accumulate basic knowledge using simplistic animal model. And this is where the flies arrive. So we use this animal because of the experimental values that it has in the lab to conduct mechanistic studies of a biological process. It has been also very productively used to study host microbe interaction and to reveal the evolutionary roots of innate immunity, thanks to the discovery of the toll gene, the toll-like receptors that led to the discovery of toll-like receptors in mammals recently. And what is very important to know is that flies live in fermenting food, so in nutritional niches, which are extremely rich in microorganisms. And despite this microbial richness in their closed environment, in their niche, they harbor very simple bacterial communities that have the characteristic of being aerotolerant. And basically, when you do community profiling of intestinal contents in flies, you find mostly at maximum 50 phenotypes, but more regularly a dozen of phenotypes associated to animals, and even a reduced amount when you raise your flies in labs. And you find mostly firmicutes and alpha proteobacteria, and those three genus are clearly the type of bacteria you find, lactobacilli, enterococci, and acetobacteria species. And you will recognize those two genus from which are also present in mammalian microbiota. What is very interesting is that we most of the time found five prevalent species, including two lactobacilli, Lactobacillus plantarum and Lactobacillus brevis, one enterococci, Enterococcus faecalis, and those two Acetobacter species. So we have here a model where we have a very good genetic tractability because we have access to genomes and genetic tools in some of those species. And obviously, we have lots of tools in the fly model to tackle the question through genetics. And on top of that, we use an in vivo model, a natural model of association, and therefore we can bypass the complexity thanks to those lower level of bacterial species to actually tackle those mechanisms. But the first question was clearly, is there a role of the microbiota for Drosophila physiology? This is a very basic and simple question. So for that, we address one very major physiological trait of this animal, which is the juvenile growth. So this is the life cycle of the Drosophila, embryonic stage. Then during few days, the larvae, the juvenile of the animal, grow and heat to increase their mass by 200-fold over just a period of 5 days when the nutritional conditions are optimal. Then you have the so-called puberty, which is the metamorphosis, and then you reach the adult stage. So this phase of the life cycle is very much influenced by the nutritional parameter. So if you reduce the protein and vitamin content of the diet, which is for the fly composed of yeast extract, if you dilute yeast in your diet, you will increase significantly the time an embryo takes to reach the pupal stage. And the animal you will get at the end of this period, that can go up to more than 20 days, and sometimes it's even lethal because of nutrient scarcity, you get tiny flies which can be reduced to by 70% of the adult size. But despite that, they are viable and fertile. Obviously, their fitness is a bit altered. We'll come into that later. While when you grow flies on the normal food, they are healthy and big. So the question we ask is the microbial environment of those animals, on top of the nutritional impact, is this environment important for the physiology for this trait? So for that, we did a very basic experiment, which was growing conventional flies, so flies that bear a microbiota, or that contains microbes in their environment, and compare the emergence, the adult emergence over time, so after egg-laying, the kinetic of adult emergence, comparing germ-free flies and conventionally reared flies on two types of diet, a rich diet and a poor diet. You clearly see when you compare conventional animals, the delay in the emergence of the adult that is mediated by the reduction of the yeast content in the food, which was previously known. You lose 2.5 days. You delay by 2.5 days the development. And which was what was very striking is that when you grow germ-free animals, there is a very limited impact, if any, on a normal diet, on a rich diet, while if you have nutrient scarcity, you clearly unmask the microbiota-dependent phenotype, and you clearly have extremely delayed animals. So you further delay by 3 days the delay observed due to the poor nutrition. So we have here clearly a microbiota-dependent developmental phenotype. So we wanted to address what are the communities associated to those animals. And as illustrated in the introduction, we sequenced the 16S DNA, RNA the community present in the intestine of the conventional animals. And we found two phenotypes, actually. Lactobacillus plantarum and Enterococcus faecalis and two other minor phenotypes. Most of the sequences match to those two phenotypes, those two species. So indeed, the microbiota in the fly is very simple and no complexity there. So now the question was really now to reintroduce those isolates to a germ-free animal and see whether you promote growth. And that's exactly what happened. So if you take a germ-free animal that has a delayed development during a nutritional scarcity, you bring back either isolates of Enterococcus faecalis or some isolates of Lactobacillus plantarum, and a given isolate of plantarum was able to re-accelerate the development very strongly and very robustly as compared to the conventional settings. So you've here the statistics and the quantification of the effect. On top of that, this is not just a maturation effect that you get adults earlier. This is clearly also the gross rate, the mass accumulation of the animal, which is increased by the lactobacilli association. So you clearly have an increase in the gross rate of the animal, which is evident very early during larval development. We are looking here at the size of the larvae during time. And this was clearly seen upon reassociation with this WGL isolate of the species Lactobacillus plantarum. So I mention here this isolate because we have a strain-dependent phenotype. So we gather different isolates of Lactobacillus plantarum from different fly labs that were isolated from fly intestine. And most of them, if not all, were actually beneficial for larval development and adult emergence. But we screen a collection of isolates that we gather from flies in our lab and from the wild, and we're very lucky to find one strain that was actually able to colonize perfectly the diet of the fly, similarly to the WGL isolate, and also the gut of the fly, similarly to the WGL isolate. But despite this ability to colonize the niche and the gut, the strain was very poor and actually inefficient in promoting growth and was behaving. Animals mono-associated with this strain were behaving very similarly in terms of development, timing of development, and their germ-free siblings. So this is very specific, strain-specific. This is a strain-specific phenotype. So then, thanks to the genetic toolkit of the fly, we could characterize some molecular players into these phenotypes, and I won't go today into the details of the genetics. It has been published some time ago now. What we characterize is the role of this TOR kinase in two key endocrine tissues in the fly system, which is the fat body, the analog of the fat mass and liver in the fly system, and the prothoracic gland, which is producing steroid hormones in the fly system. And the TOR pathway is really acting as a nutrient sensor in those two tissues to control systemic growth. And this was known previously from studies in the field about nutritional control of growth. But we were able to show that the growth mediated, the lactobacilli mediated growth phenotype needed a full activity of those two, this pathway in those two tissues to control optimal level of steroid hormone ecdysone, which controls the maturation of the fly, the entry to metamorphosis, but also the production of insulin-like peptides, the IGF, analogs in the fly systems to control growth rate. So we clearly impact both maturation phase and the growth rate thanks to the enhancement of the activity of this pathway. Now, obviously, the question we are chasing is how the bacteria translate a poor diet, which normally does not promote efficient juvenile growth, into an efficient signal to trigger optimal maturation and growth rate. So now I will share with you some unpublished data, and this is not complete data, just to see the flavor of the approaches that we are embarking on now in the lab to really try to identify those mechanisms. So how does Lactobacillus plantarum promote growth in at least in the fly setup? So for that, we do a two-sided genetic analysis. So we use the genetic diversity of many isolates of Lactobacillus plantarum to try to understand what are the genetic basis of this phenotype in the bacteria, but also into the genetic basis in Drosophila, and we use genetic diversities to start with. So for that, we had access to 42 plantarum isolates, which have been already well described and studied by the lab of Michiel Kleerbizim in the Netherlands, and we are collaborating with Sacha van Hierum, who is a bioinformatician, to actually complete the genomic studies of those 42 isolates. So we made actually the genome of those 42 strains, and we have now a near-complete matrix of gene presence and absence of those two strains, and we can compare now the ability of each strain to promote the phenotype, the growth phenotype, and come back to the gene content of that given strain and compare strain by strain and try to identify candidate genes. And we test for positive and negative correlation there by just applying random forest classification to do this linkage analysis. So the basis here is that we have a strain-specific phenotype. I recall you the results we've got previously. So what we've done is to mono-associate germ-free fly embryos with those 42 isolates and score the growth-promoting efficiency of all those strains. So here in green, you have the reference strain that I mentioned previously. In red, you have the germ-free animals. And you see that mono-associated animals, the response of mono-associated animals in terms of growth benefit, spreads over this continuum with beneficial strains and less beneficial and not non-beneficial strains in this setting here. And what we've done now is to do the correlative, the linkage analysis. We have a list of candidate genes that we are now testing thanks to the genetics of Lactobacillus plantarum in either the reference genome background, WCFS1, or the WGL background. And we have a nice candidate which is related to GluCNAC metabolism and which may be important for the adaptation of lactobacilli to the intestinal niche, which is rich in chitin composed of GluCNAC in the Drosophila model. So now what we do on the fly side, this is the same approach, the same flavor of the approach, but this time we use a tool that is existing in the community, which is called the Drosophila Genetic Reference Panel. So this is a collection of 192 inbred Drosophila lines, which genome has been sequenced by the lab of Trudy McKay and Bart Desplanck in Trudy McKay in the US and Bart Desplanck in Switzerland. And actually, those genomes are sequenced to a very high coverage. So we have a battery of thousands of SNPs which have been characterized and identified in a strain-specific basis. And those strains, actually, they illustrate the genetic diversity that one can encounter in the wild. In the wild, because all those strains were derived from 20 females collected in a market in the US, and they were crossed together and then isogenized and backcrossed for 20 generations to have this collection. So the idea is to turn all those lines germ-free and reassociate each of those fly lines with the Lactobacillus plantarum WGL strain, which is the strain we characterized initially, which potentiates the growth phenotype. So for that, we don't use adult emergence as a trait, as a readout. We use larval size as a readout, and just to illustrate the strength of the phenotype that we have, if you take germ-free animals, grow on a low-protein diet, and you mono-associate those animals with the WGL isolate, you get larvae 7 days after association, which are that big compared to germ-free larvae. So this is very visible and easy to score phenotype. So the WGL size gain is very robust in our reference yellow-white background. So now when we add up, we have more than 4,000 animals which have been tested so far. So you see the increase in larval size, which is very significant. And this is the mean value for the representative value of the larval size difference between the associated animals and the germ-free animals. And this is the trait we are studying, the larval size difference between WGL associated and germ-free. And also what is very interesting is when you compile all the results that you got in germ-free DGRP lines and mono-associated DGRP lines, you see here the distribution of all the larval size in the germ-free setup and in the WGL-associated setup. So you clearly see that the effect of the strain is conserved among all the lines. Now the question is whether this effect is variable from strain to strain. And this is the first snapshot of the results because the screen is ongoing. We've screened so far 53 lines. And you clearly see that the larval size difference parameter clearly fluctuates in the different strains with strains where you have a very strong enhancement of the phenotype, whether other strains have a reduced effect. So we have now made a pilot correlative study thanks to a JWAS approach. And we have found a very interesting SNP associated to a gene which is not known in flies, but has some molecular sequences, molecular feature that tells us it's potentially a sugar transporter, which positively correlates fairly strongly, actually, with the growth promotion strain. And we are following this lead while we also continue the screen to have the entire library. So you see, this is just to give you the idea of how we can go into the mechanisms, go into the gene functions to try to understand how lactobacilli promote growth. So the take-home message is the intestinal microbiota promotes systemic growth, and we've heard this morning that this might also be true in mouse and in mammals. Single commensal species can recapitulate the whole microbiota effect. And this is at least in the flyer system that we can see that for now. And a single commensal species actually influence hormonal growth signals such as insulin-like peptides. And this is what we presented before. So it's now quite clear that in addition to energy harvest, the microbiota is also an important parameter to study and to understand its role in controlling the systemic growth. And I like to put that in perspective with the idea that lactobacilli probiotics are intensively used in the farming industry to optimize animal growth. And also, as you know, AVD present on the market as a beneficial alimentary complement. But now I think we clearly need to chase what are the mechanisms underlying those activities. And apart the current dogma, which is to prevent and cure diarrhea in animals, which would promote growth, maybe we can think of lactobacilli-mediated effect on the gut, or metabolic effect, or systemic hormonal effects. And we are now also in the lab chasing those possibilities and hypotheses using a mouse system. And in contrast to what we heard just this morning, it's really a strain-dependent effect, and we have found some lactobacilli that actually promote growth in a mouse setting. So maybe in VSL3, it's not necessarily the good lacto which was there. So with that, I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to acknowledge the people and the funding agencies, very, very generous support these days. A very talented student, Gilles Storly, has made the initial analysis of the larval growth promotion and the first paper in the lab. Dali Ma is a postdoc in the lab doing the JWAS studies on the fly side. Renata Matos is actually embarking on the bacterial side and studying all the candidates, and we have now two postdocs joining the lab to develop the mouse project. And I thank you very much for your attention.